Let's go.
Let's go.
Oh, no. Do you want to?
Sorry. I'll let you.
Next one.
I'm excited and I feel relaxed and I'm ready to party! Don't say sorry. You don't need to do that. You don't need to apologize. It's a fucked up female habit. You don't need to be sorry for anything ever.
Can you guess what every woman's worst nightmare is?
I don't have rage issues!
I have nothing to prove to you.
When I'm good, I'm very good. But when I'm bad, I'm better.
I say when it comes to stardom and Lauren, there are no accidents.
Hi, Karen Peterson.
Hello, and welcome to Citizen Dame, the podcast where we celebrate Women's History Month and movies made by women. I'm Karen Peterson, joined by Lauren Humphreys-Brooks.
Hello.
Hello. Lauren, you are an incredible woman.
You are an incredible woman, Karen.
Oh, thank you. How's your week going?
Exhausting.
Yeah.
I'm really tired. For a whole bunch of different reasons, some of them personal, some of them professional, but which of course overlap. And then you're just like, just stop. Just everything to stop. No more.
Pretty much. Yeah. Meanwhile, I had my birthday last week and then this week I aged 50 years. So, you know.
There are times. There are times. Some of my good friends who just had babies were reminded that, like, because they're all my age, right? And their doctors kept on referring to them as having geriatric pregnancies.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, okay, there needs to be a different word for that, because that is not a cool way to state a woman in like her late 30s having a child. Like, I don't like that. It's geriatric pregnancy.
Yeah, which is the technical term for that. That is the official accepted medical like word for it. But yeah, it's wrong.
We need to change that. Because first of all, it's not that unusual now, especially for women to have children later. And mm-hmm. second of all, that's just like, I would punch a doctor who said that to me and be like, fuck you, first of all.
Yeah. In the past month or so, I've had a lot of doctor's appointments, and two separate doctors have asked, you know, like about my age, because some things that I have to do, you know, it's like they want to make sure that you're not going to get pregnant or anything. And I was like, oh, I think that ship has sailed. And two separate doctors, both women, decided to just, you know, remind me that women can have babies well into their 50s. And I'm like,
yeah.
They can, but I don't plan to be one of them.
Well, but I mean, that's the thing. And I know it becomes like, I understand some of it. It becomes more dangerous, particularly mm-hmm. the older you get. And there are certain considerations about like care and all that. And that's all totally, totally reasonable and everything. But yeah, we need to shift some of the dialogue about this because women are indeed having children much later, because yes.
And
you know, 50
year old pregnant women, that is a geriatric pregnancy.
Sure. Yeah, there should be a distinction between that and, you know, being 35 or 40 or something like that. It's
yeah.
just like somehow, I don't know.
Exactly.
Oh my god. Anyways. Yes.
Anywho. Well, I don't know if you've heard, but the Oscars are this weekend. In fact, by the time people are listening to this episode, they will have already occurred. And Oppenheimer will be our new best picture, most likely. And because of this very likely event, we thought, well, what if we spent this Oscar weekend episode talking about historical / biopic type movies that were directed by women? So that's what we're doing today. Historical films directed by women. And there are not a lot. We went through so many, like trying to like narrow down which films to do, and there weren't a lot of choices. It was really sad and frustrating. There's lots of movies about great women, but they're not directed by women. So another area where we need to do better. So.
Yeah, well, and all three of the films we're going to talk about are actually, because we were talking before we started recording, like they're not really biopics. They're like, I mean, one of them kind of is, but also it focuses on very certain things, mm-hmm. and the other two are very much about event, like historical events.
Yeah.
And that, so it's, it is this like, well, so what are these really? But it's interesting that all three of these ones are very political.
Yes.
And very much like the politics of the era, but also of course, because of the politics of the era, they're engaged with our contemporary politics, because that's part of the point. And so it's quite interesting to like see that these are the sort of films that female directors gravitate towards and really feature. Also, two out of the three are about men.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's interesting.
Right. Yeah. One of the things I want to say just on that point, though, about how these aren't really biopics is neither is Oppenheimer. It's being billed mm-hmm. as a biopic. And it does spend a lot of the time being about Oppenheimer's journey, but it's really not. It's about all the events around him. It's also a very mm-hmm. political film as well. Because guess what? Movies are inherently political. Art is political. And I don't know why people say that it's not. There's like, it's such a lack of willingness to actually admit that movies are about what they're about, I think.
Well, and if you're talking about historical events, of course they're going to be political because history is political. Like, yeah. Like the choice to build and drop the atomic bomb was a political choice. Like it had all kinds of things involved with it. Same with the one of the films we're going to talk about, and the march to Montgomery. Same with, you know, the stuff that we're going to talk about Malcolm X and Muhammad Ali, et cetera. So like, all of these things are political. History is political. Historical events are political.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So the three films that we're talking about today are Frida, directed by Julie Taymor, Selma, directed by Ava DuVernay, and One Night in Miami, directed by Regina King. So those are the films that we're going to dive into. So first of all, well, what are some of the things that that collectively, aside from the politics of them, what are some things that you feel like kind of connect these films together, tie them together?
I do think it's the politics in a lot of ways, but also particularly the fact that certainly with Selma and When I Am Miami, they're taking place fairly, you know, the events themselves are taking place fairly close together. And are obviously related to the civil rights movement in the United States. And also the fact that these are three films that are not about white people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Julie Taymor is a white woman, I believe, unless I'm completely mistaken on that one. And two of the films are being directed by Black women. But it's, you know, it's interesting because we didn't necessarily intend this when we chose the films, but I was like, oh, we picked three films that are not about white people. That's nice. That's nice to see. And the majority of the people on screen are not white people. That's the other thing. It isn't like a Black director making a movie about white people or even particularly focused on white people, but you know, making a movie about the Black experience, you know, focusing on people who are not like the mainstream, as it were.
Yeah. Being the Oscar nerd that I am, I just want to throw out that all three of these films were nominated for multiple Academy Awards. Selma being nominated for Best Picture. None of them were nominated for Best Director. But they had acting nominations and below the line, like costume and crafts nominations too. In the case of One Night in Miami, it gets nominated for screenplay. So these are also celebrated films that were recognized by the Academy and by the industry as excellent films. But still, because women make great movies and they have for a long time, but still couldn't see fit to recognize their directors.
They directed themselves.
They again. Did.
Yeah, as we talked about last week, they, mm-hmm. these films, it's amazing how many films direct themselves.
Yeah.
Especially when the director is female. Like, it's just remarkable. It's like, oh, no, woman didn't actually make this movie.
No, I mean, she was just there for the name. That's all. She, like, the rest of it just kind of fell in line, you know?
Well, I mean, we've talked about this before. I do think that some of it is just this view of kind of the autocratic director. And very often when you hear about female directed films, very often women are not like, aren't billed as being particularly autocratic. Like there's just like, you know, I think even Muriel Heller talked about how that her view of directing is like, you're kind of in charge of everybody, but you're sort of, you're guiding people, right? It's a group effort. Mm-hmm. And that her job is to make certain that the set works and is positive and all of the things that need to happen, et cetera. So she's in control, but she's also not, ruling over everybody. And I think that there's generally, whether it's true or not for every female director, there seems to be this general impression of that's how women act. And that's not really directing.
Mm-hmm. Right? You know, it's interesting because when I've had opportunities to speak with actors or with craftspeople, department heads about their experiences working with female directors on film sets. Very frequently, the common ideas that I hear from them or kind of what works about that is that women as directors tend to be more organized and more inclusive. They do want to hear from everybody else. They do want to bring everybody together to make a film together. Male directors frequently, not all, but they will come to the set very much like, this is my vision and you're going to just do what I say. And it's you do see differences in the resulting work and in the experience that people talk about having. So let's dive into Frida, which came out in 2002, and like I said, it was directed by Julie Taymor. It stars Salma Hayek as the artist Frida Kahlo from Mexico, who has a crippling injury when she's just 18 years old, and that injury did affect the rest of her life. But she was a very renowned Mexican painter, and so this is a film about her life and her relationships and her very tumultuous marriage. Is it tumultuous? I don't know. I'm not sure if that's quite the right word, but
that's a way to put it.
It's definitely not a smooth ride. So her husband is Diego Rivera, played by Alfred Molina. And you see some other folks that pop in along the way, such as Diego's ex-wife Lupe, played by Valeria Galino, and late in the film, Leon Trotsky shows up, and that's Jeffrey Rush plays him. So this also has baby Diego Luna and very young Ashley Judd and Antonio Banderas and all sorts of other folks. So Lauren, what are your general overall like thoughts about Frida?
Well, you know, this was the first time I'd seen Frida. When it came out, I missed it. My parents saw it, I remember, but I didn't see it. And so it just never materialized as something that I was watching. So I was like, oh, this is fun. I'll get to see this. So one of the things that I remember, some of the talk about it had been, you know, oh, this is about, you know, it's more about her marriage to Diego Rivera than it is anything else. And I think that that's true in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
Like the marriage is very much a focus of the whole thing. What I liked about that element of it is that, you know, it could have been so simplistic, I guess, just like, oh, he's, you know, going around sleeping with hundreds of other women and all that. But the way that they actually navigate it is quite interesting, that you believe that there is this very strong love that they have for each other. And they also drive each other crazy. And it's not a constantly positive thing, but there is this like reinforcement of their connection throughout the film. And they continue to be connected even when, like, you know, he finally does some unforgivable things and she's like, we're not, you know, you're not my husband anymore, basically. And then they kind of come back together and drift apart and all of those things. I thought it was a very interesting kind of generous interpretation of that relationship and that kind of relationship, there were definitely points where I was just like, bro, you can't be like, oh, we're in an open relationship and then be mad when you're in an open relationship. And I kind of wanted a little more clarification, because at one point he says to her, like, you know, there's this whole thing about loyalty versus fidelity. And yeah. And he's just like, and there, it seems to be this acceptance of like, he's going to sleep with other women, right? That's something that is going to happen. And he's saying, but I'm loyal to you. And then she gets really mad when he sleeps with other women. And it's one of those like, well, but didn't you, I thought that you kind of agreed that you were like, that was something that was going to, I don't know. There was a little bit of lack of clarity, and maybe that's part of the point.
I think it is part of the point. I think it's one of those things where, like, can people really have an open relationship and be fine with it? Maybe some people can, but I think that that's exceptionally rare. I think most people, like, kind of in their minds, they're fine with it. But then when it's in their face and they see it happening, then it's like, whoa, no, I'm not okay with this, because I mm-hmm. have to see this and actually know that this is happening instead of just assuming that it is.
Yeah, and it's and definitely the unforgivable thing that he finally yes. does is to sleep with her sister.
Yeah.
And that's the point at which she's like, nope, okay, mm-hmm. gone too far, which, you know, fair enough. But it's, I like the complexity with which the relationship is treated, because I didn't come away with it feeling like, oh, Diego Rivera is just a jackass. Like, he's a fantastic artist. He loves her very much. Mm-hmm. And she loves him very much. And one of the things I also liked was that there wasn't, and I don't know whether this is true historically, but his constant being like, she is a better artist than I am. Like, him constantly saying, like, she is greater in so many different ways. And even when she's running herself down and being like, oh, no, I'm not so good, he's like, no, you are. And I really liked that, because it would have been so easy to show this as being just kind of, you know, like, he gets jealous of her and sort of tries to keep her down. But he's shown at least constantly encouraging her and being like, no, you need to keep doing this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are certain things where I do wonder how historically accurate that is. Like, what was their real relationship like? But I do love the way that it's portrayed on screen, even while they're both, you know, sleeping with whoever they feel like. And fidelity is not something that either of them are willing to commit to. I agree with you. I really like the relationship that they have, and the way that almost every time they're always able to come back together and move forward together. And you see that early on when Frida is talking to his ex-wife and she's like, oh yeah, he loves you until he gets his next, you know, commission abroad, and then he's going to leave. And almost immediately that happens, but he wants her to go with him. And mm-hmm. And just seeing that connection and how important the relationship, and he's been married twice before and he's very open about that. But really early on, they established that she's different in his mind. And like, there's just something much more special. And probably what that thing is that ties them together is her talent, her skill as an mm-hmm. artist. And that's something that what I love is that he's not intimidated by it or what's the word I'm looking for? Like, he threatened? Doesn't, what's that?
Threatened?
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. He's not threatened by it. He's very, it's like he's excited by it. It's like it's the thing that kind of yeah. pushes him too, which I think is such an interesting and awesome way to show this relationship.
Yeah, it's a point of connection and respect and like mutual understanding
mm-hmm.
for the two of them. And he trusts her too. He trusts the things that she says about his art. I really liked the fact that it would have been so easy to go the sort of jealousy route.
Yeah.
And be like, oh, this, you know, man. And he was an incredibly successful artist.
Right.
But this is like this man who's like, oh, he's threatened by his wife's talent. It's just like, well, it's not that at all, actually. He loves his wife's talent. He wants her to push her talent more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he encourages her and supports that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There are just other touches about this film too that I really find myself intrigued by and drawn to, such as in the beginning when it shows this horrible accident that she's in, where she's on a like a streetcar, and this accident with a bus and a streetcar, and it's the way that it's filmed. It's like this horrible accident, she's going to be very injured, and yet you've got all these things happening. You've got glitter flying through the air and just all this color, and throughout the movie, like, you, there's just the use of color and the use of beautiful imagery, even when things are not beautiful that are happening. I really like that that juxtaposition that Taymor uses to kind of show the beauty in the horror.
Well, yeah, and it's drawing out the connections to her art. You know, you see that those punctuations of red and gold and and, you know, bright yellows and all that. And then it's that intersection of the sublime, right? It's the intersection of the terrible and the beautiful,
right?
And is very much what's present, especially in a lot of the art that they show of hers, is very much present in her artwork, of like those really stark colors and the intensity of it that isn't, like, it's not dwelling in the horror of some of the images, but is kind of emphasizing the relationship between the beautiful and the horrible. It's gorgeous. And then you get the way in which the images from the paintings merge with the images on the film, which is, I think, one of the things that the film is very praised for. I remember back when it came out, was that that intersection of like seeing the images morph into the reality of what we see in Frida. And I like that combination.
Yeah. Frida is, for me, like, I remember seeing it when it first came out, and then but I don't know if I've seen it again since then or not. I can't remember. I've definitely not seen it enough times. That's for sure. But it's a film where it's like, just this week when I was watching it again, seeing that Miramax logo pop up and just thinking about, like, oh, that's right, I forgot, you know, Weinstein was so involved in this. And this was actually something that Salma Hayek talked about very specifically, some of the interference that he ran, and he had tried to kick her off of the film. And I just, this is one of those experiences where watching it, it's like, oh man, I hate that Weinstein is so involved in this, and like his fingerprints are all over it. But at the same time, I'm so glad that they were still able to make a film that kind of rises above his influence and his involvement. I hope that this film does have a life. Like, I mean, I think it kind of, all that got came back up to the surface when Salma wrote about it, her experiences in 2017. But I hope that now that kind of Weinstein's out of commission, like, that this film kind of does have a resurgence, I guess, free from his name.
Absolutely. I think that it does, because the things that I recognize about it immediately are Taymor. And it's very much of a piece with her other work, in terms of, again, that interesting color and extremity and, you know, not telling a totally straightforward narrative. And then also Salma Hayek herself, who is such a force in the film, and is like, I always forget how small she is. She's like a tiny woman.
She's teeny, yeah.
and you can tell that throughout, like, particularly when she's next to Melina, who's, you know, and it is that, like, juxtaposition, and he's big and boisterous and all this, and she's so small, and she's just a force throughout the film. Like, she's just like, oh, no, ain't no one gonna intimidate this woman. No one. I think that combination is what makes the film great. I had forgotten until I was reading up on it again. I'd forgotten that was one of the focal points of Hayek's commentary back when the Weinstein, God, that was so long ago, and yet not that long ago.
Yeah,
back when the Weinstein stuff broke, and unfortunately, it's It's one of the things we're going to have to deal with throughout, I think, when we deal with films from this era, mm-hmm. because Weinstein was there a lot yeah. of the time. And it's not great, but the films should survive despite that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. One of the other things separate from him that I just wanted to mention about this is that another thing that I appreciate about the film is that it does not shy away from Frida's sexuality. And it's very open that she's bisexual, and it lets her indulge in those relationships. And I feel like it does so generally in a way that's also not exploitative, as much as Weinstein wanted it to be more so. Tamar was and Hayek was a producer on this too. They were able to, I think, use that that part of Frida's identity and her experiences in a way that really does help us as an audience to connect with her and to see her, not to just like ogle her.
Yeah, it's not an objectifying film, right. Particularly. It doesn't, I mean, you know, Salma Hayek is a gorgeous woman, but it doesn't treat her as an object.
Right.
And it could have. And I think that honestly, probably under a male director, it might have, depending mm-hmm. on the director. Or it might have been more, I guess, explicit about her bisexuality and made that more of like kind of a skeevy issue. I don't know.
Yeah.
And as so often happens. But yeah, it treats it with honesty, I think, and as a part of her, which is a very real part. And also doesn't make it into this, like, again, barrier between her and her husband, or like, is this, it's not dwelt on in a way that is like, oh, we're going to talk about this for a long time. It's like, this is an issue for them. It's not at all.
Right. Right. Exactly. And I think that's one of the things that I really admire about this film, whereas other versions of this, you could see it either being completely ignored and pretend like, let's just pretend that never happened, or let's just pretend she was only into girls and let's just make that the thing, you know, like to really like either ignore or sensationalize her experiences, her sexuality. Mm-hmm. But that's one of the things that I think is just so well done here, is it's just, that's just part of who she was. And it's not the only thing that we know about her when we finish watching this film.
Yeah. I again, I don't know if this was historically accurate, but I love the fact that she fucks Trotsky. Like, yes. I was just like, oh my God, she fucked Trotsky? No, you go, girl. Like, that's dang.
Yeah. Yeah, I have no idea if that really happened or not.
I mean, maybe it was one of those that's like, it might not be known, right? Mm-hmm. One way or the other, but it is one of those, like, we can maybe assume that she fucked Trotsky. I was like, okay, cool.
Let me, I'm actually Googling, let's see. They, oh, it does say, according to PBS, they did have an affair.
Oh, there you go.
Before long, Kahlo grew tired of Trotsky, whom she called the old man. After their breakup, she made a self-portrait for him, which he left behind when he finally moved from the Rivera's home. There you go. So yes, it's true. They did have an affair.
There you go.
You go, girl.
Not only fucked Trotsky, she got tired of him.
Oh man. Any other thoughts about Frida?
It's a good film. It really is. I think that it's a gorgeous one, and Tamar really just brings this wonderful imprint to it, and I enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah. And Salma Hayek is just so phenomenal in this. So
yes, she's wonderful.
Still her only Best Actress nomination of her career.
So,
yeah. All right. So now we're going to jump forward a couple of years. We're going to go to Selma from 2014, which was directed by Ava DuVernay. And this film is not just about Martin Luther King. This really is about the 1965 march the voting marches, the civil rights marches of 1965, particularly culminating in the march to Selma. And it does star David Oyelowo as Martin Luther King. We also have Tom Wilkinson as Lyndon B. Johnson. We've got Tim Roth is in this, and Common is in this. It's like a pretty big cast. Directed by Ava DuVernay, and as I mentioned, and nominated for multiple Academy Awards, including Best Picture, but not director. Anyway, I'm not bitter. Lauren, what are some of your thoughts? Actually, you know what? Before we jump into that, I do want to say on the subject of Ava DuVernay, when we talk about snubs, Oscar snubs, award snubs, I feel like DuVernay is one of those. Like, I don't like to throw that word snub around because I do think it's overused, but I do think in the case of Ava DuVernay, it's absolutely accurate and true. This is a woman who has really done some incredible work, and even when her films get recognized, she very, very rarely does. And it feels so intentional, which is odd because she is a member of the board of directors of the Academy. So I don't understand what's going on there. But she is definitely someone that I feel like qualifies as someone we can say has been snubbed by the Academy.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, I would say that she's one of the most prominent female directors working today. And the fact of that and the degree to which she has been snubbed really pisses me off.
Yeah.
It's racism and it's sexism. It's both.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
If she was a white woman, she would not be getting snubbed in the same way. If she was a black man, she would not be getting snubbed in the same way. If she was a white man, everybody would love her.
And if she was a white woman, I think that people would recognize that she's being snubbed when she's not nominated for stuff.
Yeah.
You know, that's, yeah. Anyway. But yeah, let's talk about the movie. So, Lauren, what are some of your thoughts about Selma?
It had been a while since I'd seen this one, actually. I think that probably the last time I saw it was when it came out. It's just such a well-made film. Like it does have that sensation of kind of elevating Martin Luther King as, you know, it doesn't go a great deal into the flaws of the man or anything like that, but it's also not really about that. It's about this particular political action. And I like the fact that even though he is very much the center of the story, as the leader, there's so much time and space is given to other people as well, and the efforts of other people. And even as he's kind of shaping events, and trying and not being infallible either, sometimes making mistakes, sometimes being like, I don't know what to do, right? There are all of these other characters that are surrounding him that contribute to that and kind of push him forward and push the narrative forward. It balances, I think, the characters really, really well. It gives us a lot of different focal points and a deeper understanding of like some of the conflicts within the civil rights movement and the conflicts within the broader political arena, et cetera. I remember when this came out that there were criticisms on both sides that either it was giving Lyndon B. Johnson too much credit or not giving him enough credit. And I was like, first of all, make up your minds, one or the other, like, which one are we doing? But, and again, I think that we always have to be careful, you know, this is a movie about a historical event. We should not take this as the sole interpretation of history that is correct, right?
Right.
But I did like the fact that, you know, we're seeing Lyndon B. Johnson as like, this is someone who does support this, right? But is also very political, is a white man who does not completely understand a lot of what's going on. And I like the conversations between the two of them because we get a lot of, you know, Martin Luther King saying like, you know, I'm a preacher from Atlanta. You are the president of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're not the same. And there is this back and forth about like, King being an activist, right? And LBJ being like, you know, having to marshal everything and everybody. and how those two elements conflict. And I think it comes down to very much we're on the side of Martin Luther King. It's like, this is something that needs to happen. You can't keep on putting this off. But it shows at least a little bit of Johnson's own prejudices and struggles, and also the desire to help while at the same time not wanting to go as far as he really needs to go. And so I like the way that the film balances it.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I think in the case of Johnson specifically, I think the way that he's portrayed is a good reminder to any of us who want to or consider ourselves allies, that there's always more we can do. And sometimes it means that we have to be uncomfortable, but I don't think that it does it in a way where it condemns him, but I don't think it should or needs to, you know? And so I really like that. I also just, I think just seeing the way that so many different leaders of the time kind of had different outlooks, different ideas of what this movement needed, and what the civil rights movement needed to move forward, and different approaches to that, and this specific march from Selma to Montgomery, and like, what was the right way to do it, and what was the right way to galvanize people and get them, you know, get kind of root out who was really on the side of moving with these folks and moving forward and fighting for rights, and who was actually against it, and who was just giving lip service to it, you know, who was really mm-hmm. willing to stand up. And I think that all of that is portrayed really, really effectively by DuVernay.
Yeah, I like the political insight into, you know, what actually goes on in this kind of thing, that the whole emphasis on, you know, getting the press to pay attention, mm-hmm. getting, you know, the three times that they go, I think it's three times that they go, that they walk the bridge, right?
Yeah.
And how each of those is different, and it's this escalation and an understanding of, you know, this is what needs to happen in order for this to succeed. And how that sometimes goes wrong and sometimes goes right. And there's this disagreement about what that actually means. Like, you know, the whole thing where he turns back the second time. And there's this whole argument, like, did he do the right thing? People are angry about it. People were galvanized and ready. And then, like, suddenly it's just like, no, we're going to go back. And it shows, I think, those like inner workings and how it's not always, no one's always confident in exactly how this is all going to play out. But it's important. And also the one of the things that I really like, I'm sorry, I just keep on rambling.
Yeah, me too. It's okay.
One of the things I really like is the fact that this deals directly with religion.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the time, I think particularly when white people talk about Martin Luther King, we kind of lied over the fact that he is a preacher,
right?
That's how he started out, and it is a part of God and religion, and the relationship between religion and the Black community and the white community is consistently there throughout. And all of his speeches, all of his writings are related to that. Like it's not just in the way that he talks and the techniques that he uses in his speeches, but the rhetoric that he uses, the way that he relates all of it, the way that people respond to it, et cetera, this film actually shows that, and how, you know, it's how religion is so important to this part of the movement and is also the source of conflict. And we get a little bit of that with Malcolm X as well.
Mm-hmm.
But that is also very, very important to what happens. And so the whole thing, you know, the most overt one is him calling all of the clergy and saying, like, if you believe in this, you should be here.
Right.
Why aren't you here? And the clergy responding to that, so many white clergy members showing up for it. And that being an incredibly important moment as well. And so that kind of, it's so easy to elide over that historically. And it's like, we want to not pay attention to the power that religion had within the civil rights movement. And, you know, I like the fact that this film just does not ignore it at all, or doesn't try to downplay it.
Yeah. It's a great point. It's very true. I mean, this was basically organized by the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. So, and there's a lot of like that matters. That is a very important point. So thank you for that. The other thing that I really like about this, about Selma as a film is, kind of touching on something that you were just saying a little bit ago, where it really gets into, I think when we look at historical events like this, you know, oh, the march, you know, the march, the voting marches, whatever. It's like there's being so far removed from it, several decades removed from it. There's kind of this idea that is easy to form of like, oh, well, a bunch of people just got together and went for a walk, you know, like they just did it. It just happened organically. And I think that the way this and all the leading up to it, and like you said, the three times that they crossed that bridge and the arrests and going to court and getting the president involved and all these things shows how complicated and complex this event actually was, which I think really does give greater weight and importance to it and to what really happened and to all the people that were involved, because this isn't something that could have just happened organically. This did take a lot of planning and thought and consideration and a lot of moving parts to make everything happen the way that they did.
Yeah. Well, and the fact that the way that the film represents it, at least, again, I don't know all of the historical ins and outs of it, so there may be things that are being fudged. Sure. Never take films as 100% accurate.
Please never, not even documentaries.
but the fact that it's quite obvious that Martin Luther King and his people essentially like looked at what was going on and someone was just like, this is something that this is where we need to go. And that they're very deliberately choosing places where there's going to be a difference made. And in fact, there's an entire conversation where they talk about, I think they're talking to John Lewis, young John Lewis, and his kind of compatriot in SNCC, I think they're called. But the students, right, who are like very galvanized and everything, but there's this whole conversation about, well, you screwed up in Albany and, you know, what makes you think you're not going to screw up here? And you kind of get Martin Luther King and some of his guys going through like, here's why we didn't succeed in Albany. And here's why we think we can succeed here. So it shows how, like you say, how deliberate this was. This was not something that just kind of happened all of a sudden. It was like, okay, this is a place where we can go and this can be the thing that drives this movement forward. And hopefully it'll work.
Yeah. Man, it's such a good film. And I mean, I just have to read off some of the names. I know I kind of already did some of the cast, but I mean, this cast is just incredible. First of all, like I said, David Oyelowo as Martin Luther King and Tom Wilkinson as Lyndon B. Johnson. But then you have Tessa Thompson, Andre Holland, Lakeith Stanfield, Cuba Gooding Jr., Oprah Winfrey, Ruben Santiago Hudson, Colman Domingo, just an incredible cast of people and all getting to play this part in you know, helping to bring together this story. And showing all the people who, like you mentioned, you know, Dr. King he started off as a preacher. A lot of these people were just people from the community who came together and started working together to make change. And just getting to see all these folks together, you know, on screen for one event. I think these names that, you know, you read about but usually very detached from each other, even though they're all kind of at the same time, but getting to see them all on screen together, I think is just also a very powerful image.
Yeah, absolutely. The one other thing I was just thinking about in relation to that is the way that nonviolent protest is actually represented.
Yes.
Because again, so often it's treated as like this, oh, you just don't do anything, right? Like, no, it's a specific and very powerful technique, right? Mm-hmm. For why nonviolent protest works and how it works and how it has to work.
Yeah.
And again, I think that so much of what we talk about with the civil rights movement, and particularly Martin Luther King, is we just flatten it out completely. It's just like, oh, he's so inspired. It's very milquetoast. It's very white bread. Like, just like, oh, he's so inspiring, and he was nonviolent, and he was the, just like, these were incredibly important political actions, and they were chosen for a reason, right? And there was conflict, and there was question about, is this the correct technique to use?
Right.
But it shows how powerful that technique was and how important it was to actually enacting change. And how violent the nonviolent protest becomes, right? And the whole point is that it takes a great deal of power and willpower to know that you're facing down people with clubs and guns, mm-hmm. who are going to try to hurt you, if not kill you outright. And to put your hands behind your head and say, I'm not going to resist, right? That's incredibly powerful. Yeah. And there's a reason for it. And the film shows it incredibly well.
And it's very visceral when you're watching it. Like, it's just, yeah. I mean, so, so powerful to experience that with them.
And it balances the violence really well without indulging in it or making it, you know, so again, so easily this it can become almost like, you know, you're almost an enjoyment in a weird way of like, you know, treating this as being, you know, almost, I won't say torture porn or anything like that, but that kind of weird, you know, oh, we're going to show the intensity and the viscerality of the violence. And she pulls back very carefully. She's very specific about the way that she uses the violence that is inherent in anything like this, and what she shows and what she doesn't.
Mm-hmm. It's a great film. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. If you haven't seen it ever, definitely watch it. And if it's been a while, watch it again.
Yeah. It was wonderful to watch again.
Yeah. That's the thing too, I think, just on your point of the way that that the nonviolent protests and the violence, the way that those two combine. I think that because of the way this is filmed, the way that the story is told, it's a very rewatchable film. It's mm-hmm. not one that I'm like, oh, I saw it once and I'm glad I did, but I don't ever want to experience that again.
Yeah.
So it's definitely one to rewatch. All right. And that's going to bring us to our third film this week, which is One Night in Miami from 2020, directed by Regina King. The screenplay was by Kemp Powers, and this is based on his play, which is about a real event that happened, but nobody knows quite what was talked about. So this is a night in Miami, or outside of Miami, technically, in which we see Malcolm X, played by Kingsley Benadire, Cassius Clay, who we would later know as Muhammad Ali, played by Eli Gorey, Jim Brown, the football player, played by Aldous Hodge, and Sam Cooke, the singer, played by Leslie Odom Jr. And they come together. This is after one of Muhammad Ali's fights, and they're all going to go out. But first, the four men meet together in a hotel room and have a conversation that lasts many hours. That conversation really did happen. Nobody knows what they talked about. And so this is kind of imagining what these four men at this point in their careers might have been discussing. And I think it's a very, very powerful film. It's interesting when you take a film that, or when you take a story that was originally written for the stage, and then move it to a film. Sometimes that mm-hmm. works very, very well, and sometimes not so much. And sometimes you can really feel that, like, oh, this was definitely written for a live performance. And I think that being and also single location type of films also are very difficult and tricky to pull off. And I think that this is one where Regina King did a fantastic job of, they're in a hotel room, but she really makes full use of that space. And never it somehow manages not to ever feel claustrophobic or feel, you know, stagey. And I just think that is such a difficult thing to do, and really shows her prowess as a filmmaker and just her smart eye. But specifically, let's talk about these these four men, these four actors, and the men that they're playing. What are some of your thoughts about this experience, this event overall?
So I enjoyed this film a great deal. I like the way that all four men kind of work around each other.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that you get all of it's a, for, I mean, you know, just going back to the stage thing, it's a fantastic script. So much of that is like, you know, it's very much infusing these four different characters with all of this, you know, power, et cetera. But I like the fact that it shows, you know, how each of them has navigated being not just a Black man, but a prominent Black man in the United States at this time and what that means. And the Kingsley...
Ben Adir,
yeah. His performance as Malcolm X, I think, is the thing that anchors a lot of that. And because he's the one that's kind of pushing everybody. He's saying, like, you know, you're not political enough. You're too, you know, you're not doing things correctly. And then there's pushing and pulling and push back against that. It's like, I love the argument that him and Sam Cooke get into, Sam Cooke played by Leslie Odom Jr., where, you know, Cooke, who's kind of been like he's the one who's trying to make himself palatable to the white mainstream. And then he's just like, oh, let me tell you, you know, about selling the song to the Rolling Stones. And it's so good because it is this completely different way to, you know, X's perspective of how to relate to the white world and how to become a prominent, powerful, successful Black person and also help other Black people at the same time. And you do kind of sit there and go like, is it good or bad? It's good, but also is it like it? And I think the film does a really good job at showing all of those different perspectives and not necessarily coming down on one side or the other. It's saying like, these are all things that have to be navigated, basically.
Yeah.
It's very smart.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the things that makes this such a powerful film is that you have these four very, very famous and influential Black men discussing their responsibilities as Black men and also their experiences and what do they owe to the world, if anything. And I think it's so powerful. And I think these four actors just do such a phenomenal job. It's, you know, obviously, well, maybe it's not obvious to folks, but Malcolm X and Sam Cooke both died not long after this incident would have occurred, which is in 1964. And Jim Brown actually just passed away last year. But I think just, you know, it's this like snapshot of where they are at this point in their careers and what does moving forward look like for each of them. And mm-hmm. What should it look like and what should they do? How should they navigate that? And I love that there's not a definite answer or right or wrong for any of them. But I think that, I was about to talk about something completely different for a second, but we'll come back to that. I was like, whoa, wait, that's totally changing the subject. I really like just what you were saying that, there's not a right or wrong answer. You just like, you know, not just like, but, you know, women experience some degree of this too, where, you know, how do we navigate being in a men's world and, you know, what is our responsibility, but also how do we elevate ourselves? How do we move forward? You mm-hmm. know, what do we have to give up and what should we never sacrifice, I guess?
Yeah. How to correctly be, right. you know, female mm-hmm. or Black or anything.
Yeah.
And there is, and particularly in what this film is representing, it's a very intense political moment as well. You've got Malcolm X, you've got, you know, at the time, Cassius Clay, who is, you know, kind of at the pinnacle, and, you know, he's at the pinnacle. He's just become the champ, right? He's beat Sonny Liston. So he's like right at the top. And he even says he's 22 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And you know, and so much of the, and it's interesting then to see him contrasted with Jim Brown, who is kind of not done with football, but he's kind of on the tail end of his career in football. And both of them are, there is a sensation, I think at one point, someone even, I don't remember which character says, but refers to them as gladiators, right? That mm-hmm. it's like, yeah, you're acceptable to the white mainstream because you're successful, because you can run the ball in, because you knock the guy out, but they also hate you at the same time.
Right.
And what does that mean? And you've got, you know, Cassius Clay, who is so known for, you know, grandstanding, for being like, yeah, I'm the greatest, and means it too. Like, he's mm-hmm. very much like, but it's also a part of his public persona, et cetera. And that makes him despised by a certain slice of white America, and but also admired at the same time. And it's that, you know, conflict. And then you've got someone like Sam Cooke, who's constantly, you know, at least in the way that X kind of accuses him, is constantly trying to make himself palatable to white people, is, you know, wants to be kind of in the inner circle of the white mainstream or whatever, wants to play the COPA. And you know, Malcolm X's perspective is, you're never going to be acceptable to them. You're never, mm-hmm. no one is, they might let you in, but you are never going to be acceptable.
Yeah.
And so it is, it's that combination of like, do you assimilate? Do you try to assimilate? Can you assimilate? Is that even what you really want to do? Do you resist? How do you resist? All of those things that are like wrapped up in not just the civil rights movement of the time period, but now. And you know, we keep on talking about it. And we talk about it when it comes to women. We talk about it when it comes to queer people as well.
Right.
You know, how, and then how do you just sort of navigate yourself as an individual, right? You want to be successful. You want to be comfortable. You want to not, you know, you want to have money, you want to have your own space, et cetera.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that really sets the stage, so to speak, so well for this film is that you do get little glimpses of where each of them are right before they come together for this night. Not just that Cassius Clay is the new champ. But you see Sam Cooke having this performance that's not going well in front of an all-white audience. You have Malcolm X talking about, you know, possibly leaving Nation of Islam. And then also you have this scene with Jim Brown where he goes to visit a family friend who owns a plantation, lives on a plantation, and they're having this great conversation on the porch, and he is required to stay on the porch. He's not allowed and welcome inside the house of his friend because he's Black. Mm-hmm. And so these are the kind of, this is the weight that all of them are bringing with them into mm-hmm. this night. And it really does set the tone of kind of, so it really does help you understand where each of them are coming from. Not just like a broad idea of, oh, well, I'm a football player getting ready to retire, but also I'm being actively discriminated against by people who are supposed to be my friends, even though yeah. I've reached this high level of excellence and, you know, and so that's, it really does, give some context, I think, and some gravity to the conversation. They're not just talking in terms of like philosophical argument. This is really yeah. their real life, and this is what they're dealing with every day.
Yeah, and that scene in particular with Jim Brown is so casual. Mm-hmm. The race, it's just like, oh, you know, you're not allowed in the house. Just like, are you? And they've had what is looks like this great conversation.
Yeah.
You know, just like, oh, so proud of you. I'm so proud to be from like the same place that you are. You've done such a, you know, it is this like really positive thing. And then suddenly it's just like, oh, but no.
Yeah.
And it's not even like, you it's know, like, it's not yelling. Not.
Yeah.
So of course you're not allowed in the house. It's like, are you? Oh my God.
Mm-hmm.
And then so that like the casualness, I think, is what makes it more devastating too.
Yeah.
And you see it on his face. And then also of the responses to that, but it is that like, in terms of Jim Brown, at that point, he's looking at moving from football to an acting career. Right. And he's just like, oh, well, I get to be in this, you know, this big Western, just like, oh yeah, but my character gets killed halfway through.
Right.
But it is, it shows really well how these four men are navigating that, and them all coming from different areas of entertainment, different ways of having to relate to the mainstream world, and also to other Black people and what other Black people expect of them. There's a great conversation, I think it's between Jim Brown and Malcolm X, and they're talking about shades of skin color.
Mm-hmm.
And what the difference is there a difference? And I like the fact that it doesn't turn Malcolm X into just this like, you know, political wise man or anything like that. It actually showcases, you know, the things that maybe he doesn't think about or doesn't do so well, or the his own desires and needs and the things that he's afraid of, and the unfairness with which he treats some of the other men.
Yeah. I just have to say, I love little moments of levity, like the ice cream scene. And the only ice cream they have is vanilla.
Yeah, vanilla and vanilla.
Oh, and then Malcolm X has that line where he's like, last time I checked, Brother Sam, vanilla was your flavor of choice. It's like, oh, man.
Yeah, there's a lot of humor peppered throughout, and you definitely get the sense that these men have known each other for a long time. They're friends. They're yeah. not just like, oh, we're just, you know, we're just kind of jammed in this hotel room today. It's just like, no, they want to hang out together.
Right. Yeah. Like, this isn't an arranged meeting between four people who don't know each other. This is four yeah. friends getting together for a night, you know, like I said, before they're about to go out and celebrate, like, this is just kind of a let's pregame, you know, and this is the results. And the reality is, we don't know what they talked about. Maybe they spent the whole night talking about cars. Probably not.
I would imagine not, those four men in the same room.
Yeah. Like, I think this is probably, this does tap into what that conversation probably really was. But I would like to mention that One Night in Miami, of the three films we've talked about today, One Night in Miami is the only one that is in the Criterion Collection.
Really?
Yeah.
That is interesting. I would have expected both of them to be, all mm-hmm. three of them, actually, yeah. given their historical importance, just generally. Right.
So far. Mm. Hopefully that will change. Get on it, Criterion.
Criterion, you have a serious blind spot still with female directors. You're doing better, but just generally, and particularly non-white female directors.
Non-white female directors that made movies more than 5 years ago.
Yeah, like they're, mm-hmm. I mean, I love Criterion. Criterion, you know, has my heart in so many ways, but they've not done a great job with that.
Yeah, they need to step it up for sure. So, all right. Well, any other thoughts about One Night in Miami?
That's a really good film, and you know, it is interesting how compelling it is. Like, I think that this does come, not just the script, but Regina King, mm-hmm. and the performances, just like, but her ability to make that space feel different, depending upon what they're talking about, to show different, you know, the different kind of dynamics that develop, the scene where they go up to the roof, like all of those, the moving in and out of things. Really it keeps the film interesting and dynamic. It's not just this static, like four guys talking to each other. It gets the sensation of like movement in a very confined space.
Yeah, shout out to Tammy Riker, who should have been nominated for a cinematography Oscar but was not. That's all. I really Someone admire else. Her work, so were you going to say something else? Sorry.
Sorry. No, sorry. Oh, okay. I was just looking at Tammy Riker's filmography.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, I think that's going to wrap things up then for this week. Yeah.
Yes.
All three of these films are available and you should watch them. I don't remember where they all are. I know Frida's on Pluto. One Night in Miami, I think, is still on Amazon.
Yeah. And Selma is on Paramount Plus.
That's right. I was like, where did I watch it? I don't remember. Yes.
And they can all be rented as well, I believe.
Yes. All right. Well, thank you all so much for listening. We hope that you've enjoyed this episode. We'd love to know some of your favorite historical films directed by women, too, if you want to let us know. But we would especially like to thank our patrons who help keep the show going. They are Abby, Ali, Brian, Cotter, Estefania, Heather, James, Judy, Karen, Carriata, Matt, Michelle, Monty, Nanina, Robert, Steve, Sharon, and Tao. If you would like to join them and help keep feminist film criticism and discussion in the world, you can go to patreon.com/citizendame and join us. We also have our Etsy store, etsy.com/shop/citizendamepod, and our Ko-Fi, ko-fi.com/citizendame. You can find us on our website, citizendamepod.com, where we do have some more stuff coming. We always say that, but we really do plan it. I'm doing my best, okay? And you can reach out to us lots of ways. We are available by email, citizendamepod@gmail.com, and on social media. We're on Twitter, sort of, and Instagram at citizendamepod. Blue Sky, you can find us at citizendamepod. And we are a Letterboxd HQ at citizendame. You can also find us individually. Lauren, where are you?
I am primarily on Instagram and Letterboxd at LHBusiness.
And I am on all the socials, but also primarily Instagram and Letterboxd at Karen M. Peterson. That's going to wrap this up. Next week, we're going to be talking raunchy girl comedies, and I am so excited.
It'll be fun. It'll be fun.
It will. So thank you all so much for listening, and we will catch you next time.
Bye.
Yes, yes, Cassius Marcellus Clay is the new heavyweight champion of the world, boy.
Yes, he is.
And I don't even have a scratch on my face. Oh, my goodness.
Cash.
What's
on, Cash?
What?
Cash, what?
Why am I so pretty?